You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, President Trump is out with a new proposal to revamp the nation's immigration system. It's not getting a lot of support from the right or the left. We'll talk to an immigration expert about the details. First, unsealed court documents are shedding more light on a pain treatment center in Milwaukee that was raided by federal drug enforcement agents this March. Authorities seized hundreds of medical and business records after flagging the clinic as a potential overprescriber of opioid painkillers. It's the latest facility in the Milwaukee area to come under federal investigation in the last year for alleged mishandling of addictive drugs like OxyContin. Bruce Felmetti is a reporter covering legal affairs for the Milwaukee Journal-Sentinel. Bruce, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
Well, let's start with this most recent federal raid you just wrote about at a clinic called the Milwaukee Pain Treatment Center. What are we learning about why the Drug Enforcement Agency was looking into it?
It appears they were looking into it for the same reason they've looked at other clinics in this area. They have all kinds of indicators now stemming from their finally stepped up crackdown about opioid abuse. One is they get calls from patients, former staff, and critically pharmacists who notice, you know, what they consider inappropriate levels or combinations of drugs or, you know, frequency of customers or where they're coming from. And they alert all this to authorities who now have all this information to kind of piece together and find places that may or may not be abusing, you know, their prescription powers.
Now, the DEA released a lot of information about their warrants. As I understand it, there are no charges yet. But what are some of the points of concern raised in these searches?
Well, the most recent one was, as you mentioned, it was 56 pages. It was a little more detailed than some of the others that we've written about here in the Milwaukee area. And it's because I think it's just a bigger clinic that's been in operation longer. The things they point out are, these are factors that the investigators say are red flags for pill seekers. They call people who may not be using them for legitimate pain treatment, that are maybe using them to get high or to sell to other users. And what they're noticing are, you know, the doctors, now this is all according to former employees and such, that they're letting people come in and just pay cash and leave with these large prescriptions. The lack of checking for patients' recent conditions and see how they're doing, how are they doing since the last time they prescribed the drugs. I guess they imply that you should be doing more diagnosis each time instead of simply, you know, refilling the prescriptions. They're also looking at things like tests. You do these urine screens at most of these prescription centers, one, to see that you're not using some sort of illegal street drug, but also, two, to see that the drugs they've previously prescribed to you are in your system. You know, if they prescribed you a bunch of OxyContin last month and you're supposed to be taking it regularly and you come in for the test and there's none in your system, they kind of like, well, what are you doing with the pills? So all those are kinds of factors that they prompt their concern.
Another point you wrote about that may seem counterintuitive, this pain treatment center was one of the largest prescribers of small-dose painkillers, which it doesn't seem like it makes sense, but it turns out these might be more favored by addicts than higher-dose ones. Why would that be?
I think that's a result of one of the steps taken recent years by the manufacturers at the urging of regulators, I think, that the larger pills, if you crush it, and they've now, you know, you crush all the pills and snort them or inject them to get high or abuse them. And they finally decided to put in an agent in the larger tablets that sort of limits the effectiveness over time, like a time release factor into the pill. But they only did that with the largest pills. And so people who want to abuse them would rather have the smaller pills, which don't have the time release agent built into the pills. And then they see a change at this particular clinic. They claim to have seen a change, you know, a drop off in the larger pills and an increased number of the smaller pills being prescribed.
What have the operators of the Milwaukee Pain Treatment Center said in response to this warrant and the search?
Well, they, unlike most of the owners and subscribers of some of the other places you've written about who haven't said anything, they did release a statement through their lawyer and basically said, look, you know, we've been doing this a long time. It's really complicated stuff for some of these patients to get the right combinations and the right drugs and the right timing. and you know, that they have changed their approach after the medical community reassessed what's good or bad. They claim they're cooperating. They claim that this is sort of bad faith by the government to unseal the search warrant before any criminal charges are brought, in an effort to kind of force them out of business, you know, by bad publicity.
Talking to Bruce Valmetti from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel about a recent search at a Milwaukee pain treatment center looking for evidence of improperly prescribed opioid medications. And Bruce, as you've touched on, this is the latest. This isn't the only. Can you talk about some of the other comparable searches you've seen in the Milwaukee area in the last year or so?
I alone have written about, I think, three other searches, and I'm sure there's many that we're not aware of. I think it all kind of started back in, I think, January of 18. The U.S. attorney, both here and in Madison, the two U.S. attorneys sent out letters to, I think it was 181 prescribers around the state, telling them, look, we think, based on this statewide database about, you know, prescription practices, we think maybe you're out of whack. And I don't, my hunch is, they haven't said this, but my hunch is that they then went after the clinics or the prescribers that didn't give them sufficient response to that warning, perhaps, you know, that they're the ones they started to go after. And, you know, the same similar thing, they've looking for the same kinds of red flags that I described, people coming from long distances, people going to several places in a certain short of time. And these are things that the statewide database has really helped all both prescribers and law enforcement kind of crack down on. There's a new statewide database that tracks all the prescriptions. So if I'm a doctor and you come into my clinic and I'm sort of curious about your demeanor or what you claim is your history, I can look you up and find out that, oh, you have been getting a lot of painkillers from a lot of different doctors over a short period. That might tell me, you know, you go should see somebody else. Same thing if you're a pharmacy. If you are suspicious of someone coming in with a prescription, you can find out how many other prescriptions they've gotten for how many kinds of pills from different places over a certain time. And it helps them flag this to law enforcement, and law enforcement can also add information. If they go to a scene of a near fatal overdose, for instance, and they find out about a patient, they can alert the database and say, you know, this person had what we think is a suspicious near fatal overdose. And that can go on the record. So all kind of has helped, I think, eliminate and reduce some of the improper prescribing.
For those other facilities you've reported on, what's their current status? Are they still in operation or have they been shut down?
Well, the one that's led to an actual indictment was a place called the Clinical Pain Consultants out by the Mayfair Mall. They've been shut down because, you know, they were charged. It's a woman who is, I think, a nurse practitioner and was allowed to prescribe. And that case is still pending, but they recently, superseding indictment was recently filed, adding a count claiming that somebody did fatally overdose at, like, 2 or 3 days after getting a big prescription of opioids from this clinic. So that case is pending. The others were kind of hard to tell if they were open or not anyway, because they were kind of small and had erratic hours. So I can't swear that they've all been shut down. I know that probably most have at least cut back and have become a much more concerned about how they're doing things, and now they know they're being investigated. And I've gotten a lot of phone calls from patients from another kind of a small clinic in Brookfield. After we wrote about the review there, several patients either emailed or called me to say, boy, you know, it's too bad. This was the last guy that I could go to, and sort of defending his practice of giving them the pain medications they need to even get on with life. These are people who claim that, you know, they legitimately need the pain medications, and he was the sort of last resort for them, and now they're in pain and chronic and can't function.
And I know that's a big concern here. If people who are in pain and are, I guess, legitimately using these drugs, or even people who are addicted to these kind of sketchily obtained prescription drugs, the concern is, are they then going to turn to unreliable street drugs? Who knows what the dosage is? Is this a concern being brought up as these investigations are going on?
I think that's a concern that actually prompted a lot of the investigation. You know, we had the heroin death binge a couple of years ago that started, and many, many, many of those people had been addicted to legal prescription drugs, either that they had been prescribed themselves and became addicted to, or, you know, started using from people who had them legitimately and sold them to them. So I think that, yeah, that is a big concern. But it's also a concern that there are some legitimate patients who are now having a hard time managing their pain because they were used to getting a certain dosage of opioids. And that was addressed also by the Dr. Stein response. I mean, he pointed out that the CDC itself just recently kind of issued an update on this guidance that it issues to prescribers about opioids, saying, hey, we've come to understand that in response to our last guidance, you all have been maybe cutting back too much too soon, you know, leaving some deserving patients sort of out on a limb. And so they kind of reminded practitioners, look, you know, we're not trying to indict everybody. We want you to just cut back if you're over-prescribing, but that doesn't mean just stop prescribing opioids to everybody because some people legitimately still need them.
We'll leave it there for now. Bruce, thanks a lot for joining us today.
You're welcome. Glad to be on.
Bruce Valmetti is a reporter covering legal affairs for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He was with us to talk about a series of federal investigations into Milwaukee area clinics for alleged overprescribing of opioid painkillers. Coming up, we'll talk about what a merit-based immigration system would look like under a new proposal from the White House. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we continue our look at Wisconsin's relationship with alcohol with a close look at Wisconsin's OWI laws. We'll talk about arrest trends, convictions, and efforts to strengthen the laws in the legislature. First, President Trump rolled out a new immigration proposal last week. It's already getting a skeptical reaction. The plan would make big changes to the country's current system, moving away from one that prioritizes family to instead focus on what the administration calls a merit-based system. Here's the president announcing the plan at the White House Rose Garden last week.
Our plan achieves two critical goals. First, it stops illegal immigration and fully secures the border. And second, it establishes a new legal immigration system that protects American wages, promotes American values, and attracts the best and brightest from all around the world.
Elise Cohen is an immigration expert and professor of political science at UW Green Bay. Elise, welcome back to the show.
Great to be with you, Rob.
Well, give us the broad strokes. What do you see in this plan from the White House to move to what they're calling more of a merit-based immigration system?
Yeah, this is really interesting. When we think about a year ago, a little more than that, in February of 2018, we can perhaps think the Trump administration may have been laying some initial groundwork for this. If you remember, back then we had his criticism of what he called chain migration, where they were really undermining this idea of the current system that's based primarily on family-based reunification rather than merit-based or skills-based. And so there may have been a little bit of a kind of intuition that we were headed in this direction if we were following things a year ago. But this is the first time we really see directly head on this discussion of overhauling the current system. It's expected to be perhaps the brainchild of Jared Kushner, his son-in-law, and one of his senior advisors, and something that's not as hardline as Stephen Miller's. So, for example, it would not reduce the overall number of immigrants legally permitted per year, but rather it would rebalance and reallocate that amount.
I want to give a little more of a listen to the president announcing this proposal and the tone he uses here.
Our proposal builds upon our nation's rich history of immigration while strengthening the bonds of citizenship that bind us together as a national family.
And Elise, as you mentioned, the number of legal immigrants allowed in doesn't change under this proposal. It's a different tone than we're used to hearing that tends to be more overall negative, it seems like, from the White House about all kinds of immigration.
You're absolutely right, Rob. What we hear is this rhetoric that actually puts Democrats in a really tough position. And that may be part of the strategy by saying, you know, this is actually pro-immigrant. This is something focused on how immigrants strengthen the country. Well, this is rhetoric that liberals and Democrats often use to describe why immigration is a net benefit. So in this sense, it's sort of painting them rhetorically into a corner that if you really believe immigrants strengthen the country because of the skills and the contributions they make to the economy, then why would you in any way be opposed to rebalancing the system to focus on merit-based or skills-based? So in some ways, we could see this maybe as kind of his 2020 election campaign, part of his immigration platform for 2020, but does make it really hard for Democrats to reject or argue against it.
Looking at family-based immigration and allowing someone to come in if, say, a spouse or a parent is already a U.S. Citizen, already in the U.S. Legally, talk about that. Is that a big departure from what we've seen historically in the U.S.?
Well, when he was criticizing chain migration last year, we saw a lot of misinformation. There was this idea that maybe nephews and cousins and aunts and uncles and all of these extended family members are being brought in, which is not the case. It's very strict, particularly if we're not looking at U.S. citizens, if we're just looking at the legal permanent residents, then they would only be able to bring in their spouse or their young children that are not adults. And so in that sense, it wouldn't mark a big departure. There was something I noticed in his speech, which was kind of interesting. He talked about new citizens also being limited to those categories. So whereas right now, if you're already a U.S. citizen, you could maybe bring your adult siblings, you know, request to bring in your adult siblings or perhaps your parents on a visa. He's saying in the speech, at least that he gave, that that may no longer be acceptable under his proposal.
Talking to Elise Cohen, immigration expert and professor of political science at UW-Green Bay. Elise, a lot of people have been pointing at one thing not addressed in this proposal from the White House, DACA recipients, Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. Do we see anything at all about that?
Yeah, that's a really great point to mention here. One of the reasons that people reading kind of the debate surrounding this are questioning how much of it could actually occur in legislation that's proposed, are sort of skeptical that this is really going to be a policy plan, is the absence of the Deferred Action for Childhood, the DACA recipient status. There's nothing about the status of those current undocumented or unauthorized immigrant groups that he actually specifically mentions. And so this could perhaps indicate it's really more of like the speech and the platform for his 2020 campaign rather than something ready to go as a bill to be put forward by Republicans in either of the chambers.
Elise, you've talked to us about asylum seekers in the United States in past shows. What does this plan say when it comes to asylum?
Well, that is a really interesting part of this. If you look carefully at the language he uses in the speech, we see that he gives a couple strong language choices or phrasing choices when he talks about asylum. He describes it as a broken asylum system. He talks about the abuse of asylum, kind of doubling down on some earlier claims that his administration officials had made that there may be fraud or somehow illegitimate asylum applicants that are not truly fleeing a well-founded persecution. And you do see some of that in his speech. There's also this language that suggests the proposal would entail cutting back who is eligible to apply for asylum, which raises some concerns about possible violations of international law. So when we see the part or the component that emerges on asylum, that's where we see it's a little bit more in line with familiar themes of what we've heard before from the administration.
Now that and the lack of DACA protections, those are reasons Democrats might not be happy with this. It looks like some immigration hardliners are already reacting negatively, saying, hey, wait, we don't see any reduction in the number of legal immigrants that we've been hoping for from the president. What kind of reactions has this gotten from immigration opponents?
Yeah, that's a really fascinating angle. So you're absolutely right. We've heard some of those more restrictionist individuals writing letters to the editor, for example, someone affiliated with the Center for Immigration Studies in D.C., which is a very immigration restriction-focused think tank, saying exactly that. Well, it's not being restrictive enough because it's not lowering the overall number of legal immigrants allowed in. What's really interesting here is if we look closely, again, at some of the things hinted at in his speech at the Rose Garden, we may see the potential, even if it's not explicit, that ultimately if something like this were to become a bill that would be successful, it could still produce overall lower numbers because we see, for example, it would require English proficiency at a level that isn't currently required unless you are applying to become a naturalized citizen. It would require passing a civics exam, which again, that's something reserved only for those people that are trying to naturalize to become U.S. citizens right now. now. And in his speech, President Trump suggested this would be required for any immigrant in order to even get a visa, that they would first have to pass the civics exam. So if we would actually look at putting something like that into practice, it may in effect make it so much harder and the process more difficult to immigrate that we could see ultimately a drop in the overall numbers. It's just not being framed explicitly as purposefully trying to do that at this point.
And this idea of merit-based immigration seems to focus more on people with things like college degrees, as you just mentioned, more advanced English skills. There are concerns about from employers here in Wisconsin on dairy farms, among other places, service sector jobs. How would they be affected by this change?
Yeah, that's another really important angle of this. He mentions Canada, Australia as sort of models, and they do use this point system that gives a lot more preference in being able to immigrate legally if you have advanced degrees or if you have special skills. One thing to keep in mind is the Canadian and Australian systems, they have a lot more flexibility, so they can really adapt what those skills-based requirements would be according to changing labor market demands. The way we have our system in the U.S., where these per country caps and so on are set by Congress, it would be much harder to be adaptive to the labor market demands. And I think that's where you could see those concerns of, for example, dairy farmers or other service industries saying, well, how is this going to affect us if our system isn't really set up at the moment to handle those changes?
And briefly, as we wrap up, Elise, we've mentioned opposition to this proposal from both sides of the aisle. Is it likely we're going to see big moves on immigration between now and, I don't know, Election Day 2020?
Oh, yeah, a great question to end on. It's unlikely that we're probably going to see in Congress bills that are able to get traction to go through both chambers. But I think it's incredibly likely that we're going to see this being one of the lead, if not the lead, campaign platform issues for Trump and for Republicans heading into 2020.
Elise, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Great to be with you, Rob.
That's Elise Cohen, professor of political science at UW Green Bay. She was with us today to talk about President Trump's proposals for changes to the nation's immigration system. Coming up, we'll take a closer look at what the data shows us about drunken driving arrests here in Wisconsin and how they've changed over time. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 7 on The Morning Show, do moms and dads split the housework evenly these days? Not so much, according to the author of the new book, All the Rage, Mothers, Fathers, and the Myth of Equal Partnership. Find out more tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. First, in a state where drinking is embedded in the culture and most people wouldn't consider watching a Packers game without a beer, a group of Republican lawmakers are proposing a handful of bills to strengthen Wisconsin's drunk driving laws. Corrine Hess reports that this could mean Wisconsin might finally criminalize first-time OWIs.
Jennifer Kilburn is walking on a treadmill in her Kenosha home. Today, that's an accomplishment. In the past, there were only two things that could keep the 41-year-old from being outside, her 12-hour nursing shift or the pouring rain. But on August 9th, everything changed.
I was T-boned by a drunk driver. I don't remember the accident at all.
Jennifer was taken by Flight for Life to Milwaukee.
My pelvis was broken into over 20-some-odd pieces. My thigh bone had gone right through my pelvis, and it pushed my intestines right through my diaphragm and into my left lung cavity.
The accident was on a Thursday. Jennifer was unconscious until Saturday.
Luckily, I had family and friends around me that were telling me where I was at and what had happened, I guess over and over again until it finally sunk in that I had been on my way to work and I had been hit by a drunk driver. And the surprising thing about it was that the guy who hit me had been pulled over 2 hours prior for drunk driving.
26-year-old Jesse Liddell had been arrested at 2:20 a.m. for drunk driving in Pleasant Prairie. Wisconsin is the only state that does not criminalize drunk driving on the first offense. It is treated as a traffic violation. State law allowed Liddell to be released to his mother. She promised not to let him drive. But he did and smashed into Jennifer's silver Honda at 4:50 a.m. A handful of bills in the state legislature would stiffen the penalties for drinking and driving. One would criminalize a first operating while intoxicated offense as a misdemeanor. If passed, it would increase the penalty to a $500 fine, 30 days in jail, or both. State Representative Jim Ott introduced the drunk driving bills.
There's too much drunk driving in Wisconsin. Too many people are injured. Too many people are killed. Too many wrong-way drivers. Too many people being smashed into.
Wisconsin lawmakers also want offenders to stay in jail until they are sober and to appear in court if they receive an OWI citation. If a person kills someone drinking and driving, Ott wants them to serve a 5-year prison sentence. If they've been convicted 5 or 6 times for an OWI, he wants the fine to be $25,000, up to 10 years in prison, or both. Detractors argue the state's court system can't handle the influx.
As far as flooding the court system, you know what? I don't care if it floods the court system. If somebody commits a crime, they ought to go before the judge.
Neighboring states have stricter laws. In Minnesota, a first offense is punishable by 90 days in jail and a $1,000 fine. In Illinois, the fine is $2,500 and up to 1 year in jail. But not everyone agrees harsher penalties are the right answer for Wisconsin. Jim Hazley has taught a class for first-time OWI offenders at Waukesha County Technical College for 45 years. Hazley believes educating people about Wisconsin's laws and potential consequences is more effective.
If we had to have one-third more people go through of our circuit courts, we'd have even a bigger backlog.
The state's powerful Tavern League hasn't opposed Ott's bills, but league lobbyist Scott Stanger says the group doesn't think they will pass.
There's been a combination of programs and laws that seem to be most effective when they're targeted at education, a treatment, and then programs to change people's behavior, like safe ride and rideshare programs.
It took about 3 months, 4 months before I was able to really walk.
Before the accident, Jennifer was a fitness enthusiast and an avid runner. She underwent 5 surgeries during her 15 days in the hospital. Doctors have told her she won't run again.
If the law had been different, if he hadn't been able to be signed out, then he wouldn't have hit me. It wouldn't have happened. Since I can't go back and change what happened to me, I'd like to prevent this from happening to somebody else in the future.
This is not the first time lawmakers have tried to strengthen Wisconsin's drunk driving laws, but this session, it could gain traction. A handful of Republican lawmakers support it, and Democratic Governor Tony Evers says he believes it is time to make a change. Corrine Hess, Wisconsin Public Radio.
You can read more about this story and see the rest of our series, High Tolerance, at WPR.org/alcohol. Now we continue our conversation about OWI laws in Wisconsin. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the idea of stricter punishments for repeat drunk driving, for first-time drunk driving? What do you think is the right way to tackle this problem? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Will Cushman joins us. He's associate editor of WisContext and author of the piece, OWIs in Wisconsin Are Dropping, But There Are Still Tens of Thousands Each Year. Will, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Well, there seems to be a consensus, Will, that we have too much drunk driving still in Wisconsin. But you do, looking back over the long term, see some good news. What do you see when we look at rates of accidents, fatalities, and arrests over the 20, 30 years?
Sure. They're going down quite a bit. In particular, the data around arrests show that from about 2007 to 2017, the number of OWI arrests in the state has declined by about half. So that's quite a big decline in 10 years.
And that, as always, when you look at numbers, that could mean fewer people are driving drunk. It could mean that there's less enforcement. There's no indication that there's less enforcement going on.
Right. No, there isn't. We actually were trying to figure out some of the reasons why there is such a big reduction in the number of OWI arrests over 10 years. And it seems that there are a couple laws that were passed in the late 2000s that might be in play there.
Yeah, what are those laws that might have sent that message?
Sure. First, in 2008, Wisconsin became an implied consent state. Basically, that means that anyone who's driving on a public roadway in Wisconsin is they're considered to have given consent for a blood draw or a breathalyzer test, any other test by if law enforcement requests it to check their blood for intoxicants, including alcohol. And then a couple years later, Wisconsin Act 100 increased the penalties for OWIs kind of across the board, including a requirement for ignition interlock devices for OWI offenders if they had a BAC of 0.15, which is about double the legal limit, and all repeat offenders as well.
Now, we're lucky when we get to read your pieces like this, Will. We get to see the end result. It took some doing to break down these numbers because of how things are reported at different levels to the county, to the state. What kind of obstacles do we run into when we try to figure out how much drunk driving we have?
Right. When I started reporting this story, I think I was a little naive about how easy it would be to get this data. It actually was pretty hard, and or not super hard, but harder than I thought it would be. And that's partly because several different agencies track different types of OWI data. So the Department of Justice tracks arrests. The Department of Transportation tracks convictions. The Department of Corrections tracks sentences if they are for felony OWIs or for OWIs where the sentence includes state prison or probation time. And then the hardest bit of data, which we actually were not able to get, is the sentencing records for those lower level offenses, the offenses that are not felonies. So that's first, second, and third offense OWIs. And that's because each of Wisconsin's 72 counties maintains those records. And when there are thousands of OWIs every month, trying to get a hold of those records from one county, let alone all 72, is quite a task.
You mentioned repeat offenders. What do we know about the role that the repeat offender, the person getting the fourth or fifth, or we see in the paper 10th or 12th drunk driving arrest, have on these numbers?
The number of repeat offenders has gone down as well, pretty much across the board, until you get up to the 10th plus repeat offenders. So the state data goes all the way up to 15th OWI. And for 10 to 15th, that we didn't really see a reduction in those over the last 10 years, but there's only up to about a dozen every year anyway. So I wouldn't necessarily expect there to be a big reduction. But in first offense, second offense, third, fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh, you see a reduction kind of across the board over the last 10 years.
When it comes to punishment for just about any crime, there's some discretion for prosecutors and judges over how much of that penalty to assess. What do we see when it comes to drunk driving? Are people at the light end of the range, middle, or top?
Yeah. The Department of Corrections data show that the sentences are generally on the lighter side of the penalties that are prescribed in statutes. Again, that data that we got only applies to fourth and up OWIs. But we did see that while the average sentence fell within those penalty prescriptions, it ended up being on the lighter side. But I should say that we only were able to get those sentencing data in aggregate, so like an average of the sentences that were handed down. And I do know that a 2015 investigation by some other newspapers in Wisconsin showed that sentencing varies drastically depending on the judge who is doing the sentencing.
Talking to Will Cushman with WisContext about his look at drunk driving arrests and convictions in Wisconsin. You can see his reporting and the charts he put together at wiscontext.org. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you surprised to hear the number of OWI arrests has gone down over the years in Wisconsin? Do you think stricter drunk driving laws would help reduce drunk driving even more? What changes, if any, do you think lawmakers should make to our drunk driving laws? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about drunk driving here in Wisconsin, what the numbers tell us, and efforts to change the state's drunk driving laws. Will Cushman is with us from WisContext. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think Wisconsin needs to change its laws when it comes to drunk driving? What kind of changes would you like to see? Have you been affected by a drunk driving accident yourself? If you're a member of law enforcement, what do you see when it comes to drunk drivers? Call 800 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll go to your calls. Jane is with us in Madison. Jane, hello.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What do you think, Jane?
Well, I don't think we need to toughen our laws, but what I think we really need to do is we need to change the culture in Wisconsin, and we should attack it somewhat the way we did with the smoking campaigns and eliminate advertising for alcohol products. We need to not make it so romantic and like it's something you have to do all the time.
Jane, thanks a lot for that call. We'll go now to Paul with us in Janesville. Paul, hi.
Hi. I would like to focus on the bar. I think most drunk driving starts at a bar, and therefore I would like to see the rules stricter and would appreciate if you'd let me get through my short list. Number one, all personnel serving alcohol should have to have a bartender's license. That's not currently the case. Only a bartender has to be on the premises. I'd like to see video camera surveillance whenever the bar is open, so it's easier to see if a bartender is over-serving. I'd like to see a breathalyzer at the door that the customer can choose or not choose to use. Also, I'd like to see bars required to have food service instead of just being able to sell only alcohol.
Paul, thanks a lot for the call. So we've heard a couple different callers there, Will. One saying, don't make it stricter. It's a culture message. One saying, make it stricter in this one particular way. Over time, it seems like Wisconsin has slowly moved in the direction of stricter drunk driving laws and enforcement.
That's true. Yeah. Including until fairly recently, actually, in December 1st of last year, 2018, new law went into effect that permanently revokes licenses for repeat offenders for the fourth offense and up, which is new in Wisconsin. Before, there was never a lifetime revocation of a driver's license, no matter how many times you were drunk driving.
And what do we look like when we see look at data for sentences of felony OWI offenses in particular? As we've mentioned a lot in this series, first offense is not even a misdemeanor. It takes a while to get to felonies. What did you see when you started to look at felony data in Wisconsin over the years?
Yeah, the data looks like, so what we got from Department of Corrections was from 2011 through 2018. Mm-hmm. And the sentences are getting ever so slightly harsher over that time period, not by a lot, but a little bit harsher. And the sentences, as we talked about a little bit earlier, are generally on the lighter side of what's prescribed in penalties.
We're talking about drunk driving in Wisconsin. The data that we've seen, the changes over the years in enforcement, arrests, and crashes and fatalities. Will Cushman is with us from WisConText. And we're getting your thoughts on what, if anything, you want to see change in Wisconsin's laws and maybe experiences you've had yourself. Go back to your calls now. Anita is on the line in Whitewater. Anita, hi.
Hi, this is Anita.
What did you want to tell us about, Anita?
Well, I wanted to call in and relay my experience as a victim of a woman who had three OWIs, suspended license, uninsured, hits me head-on in my lane, couldn't miss her. She, before we went to trial, had two more OWIs, and I testified they were going to give her 6 months. And this is after five, after totaling my car. I went to a trauma center. A year and a half later, I have permanent damage. You know, a couple hundred thousand dollars in medical and all of that kind of thing. So I'm very much in favor of strengthening our lives. The victims, we have to think about the victims, not only someone like myself, but I have grandkids in my car on a regular basis. And God forbid they were with me that day because they could have been seriously injured or killed. So I just... you know, we need to do something in Wisconsin to do better. I mean, the victims and what you do to people who are injured with irresponsible drivers who are drinking and driving, and it's really a concern.
Anita, thank you so much. I'm sorry you went through that horrifying experience, but thank you for sharing that story with us. And Will, we were talking about the numbers on those repeat offenders, like the person who crashed into Anita. It almost seems like that's a special subcategory as lawmakers look at this that is just a particular subset of this problem that they're tackling.
Yeah, but it's a persistent one. Mm-hmm. The data showed us that while convictions across the board have been falling since the late 2000s, including for most repeat offenders, the proportion of convictions for OWIs that are for repeat offenders has held remarkably steady at about 1 in 3 convictions. So even as the total number of OWI convictions and then repeat offenders has fallen across the state in all counties, that proportion remains pretty steady. It's fallen a little bit, but it remains pretty steady at about 1 in 3 OWI convictions in the state is for a repeat offender.
Anita, thanks again and best wishes as you continue to recover. Back to your calls. Tom is with us in Oconomowoc. Tom, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Tom?
You know, the strengthening of the laws has reduced the number of convictions in the last 10 years by half, but also Uber has done so. And and to verify that, you just ask any Uber driver.
Tom, thanks for the call. So, Will, I don't know if this comes out in the data you looked at, but is that a going theory that maybe more availability of another way to get home from the bar probably is helping here?
Yeah, I think that's really interesting. Tom, I've heard that anecdotally as well. But I did look at that in the data. So Uber came to Madison and Milwaukee markets in the beginning of 2014. So I looked at the data to see if there was an extra reduction in convictions after 2014. I didn't really see anything. I should mention I'm not a professional statistician or a social scientist, mm-hmm. So my findings are – take them for what they are. But I did not find an association with rideshare apps coming to a market and a reduction in OWIs.
Thanks for that call. But also, I mean, just looking at the charts, I'm not a statistician either, but the drops were happening before the year that ridesharing started.
Exactly. They were. They started in about 2008.
Thanks for that call. Let's go to Bob now in Roberts. Bob, hi.
Hey, so I think they should strengthen the laws quite a bit. I've actually known quite a few people that have had multiple DUIs or DWIs, and even having 2 or 3 offenses, they still think it's okay where they're like, oh, it's all right, I'm just going to go in for the weekend if I get caught. I think the first time I can understand, you know, if you go out to like dinner or something with your family or whatever it may be, you know, you have a couple drinks. Okay, first offense, kind of a more of a slap on the wrist. But if you're doing it more than once, there's a habit being built there that's not positive.
Bob, thanks a lot for the call. And so people will, I assume, are taking data like yours and try to figure out, as Bob was, what works for each level. So what kind of things are you watching for now, Will, as we see new efforts in the legislature and where the trends are going to go in the future? What's the next part of the story that you're watching for?
I think it will be interesting to see if first offense OWIs are criminalized. Right now, the only time that a first offense OWI is a misdemeanor offense in Wisconsin is if a passenger in the car is under 16. Otherwise, it's, as we heard, just a traffic violation. I would also be interested to see if the sentencing for other OWIs might become harsher. Right now, there is no confinement sentence for first or second offense OWIs, so no jail time. And then third offense, the minimum jail time is 5 days. And we saw in the data for other OWI convictions that the sentencing tends to be on that lighter side.
We'll leave it there. Will, thanks a lot for sharing your data with us.
Thanks so much, Rob.
That's Will Cushman, associate editor at WisContext. He was with us today to talk about his story looking at drunk driving trends in Wisconsin and some of the state's laws dealing with OWIs. You can find his piece online at wiscontext.org and find lots more from our series High Tolerance over at wpr.org/alcohol. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, a guest says the concentration of wealth and power is the biggest threat to American democracy. We'll meet the author of the new book, Entrenchment, Wealth, Power, and the Constitution of Democratic Societies. State lawmakers are introducing a plan to create automatic voter registration in Wisconsin. We'll get the details, and you can tell us what you think of the idea. And we'll look at the challenges facing rural parts of Wisconsin when it comes to finding treatment options for people dealing with alcoholism. We'll hear about the latest efforts to turn things around. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's the morning show with Kate Archer Kent. Tomorrow at 6, if you've been out driving, you may have seen some potholes. Kate and her guests look at road conditions around the state and what it would take to fix things up. That's tomorrow at 6 on the morning show. Up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then the company behind the SAT exam will include a measure of student adversity along with their test scores. We'll learn more about the move and how it could change the game for students from low-income areas. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.